Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I'm going to get the Chiron working here through Thanksgiving. I've been working on that when I'm having my leftover scoops of Taharka Brothers pumpkin spice latte. We're going to have an incredible deal here at Baltimore Positive. I'm going to hold the chocolate love up because the deal is full of holiday love. We're going to be giving folks $15.70 off an 8-pack delivered to your door of the best ice cream in the world because it's made with local water and local creams. It's Taharka, made in Baltimore, served up with social love and social pride, and we're going to be delivering that throughout the holidays. Also, our friends at State Fair in El Guapo. I had Evan Brown on last week talking about the menu and curbside and carryout in these difficult times for local business. It's so, so important here as we get up on Thanksgiving and the holidays and Black Friday and Super Monday and Cyber Wednesday and all of that, that we're delivering locally. Make sure you're taking care of your neighbors, folks. Our friends at State Fair and El Guapo and our friends at Fadley's. If you are shipping those crab cakes anywhere around the world here, consider our friends at Fadley's. They're also one click away from making that happen. I had a chat with Jeff Moeller last week from Moeller and Gary Realty as well, talking about the 2021. We're going to be folks that are going to be listing our place next year and trying to move around a little bit here amidst the other side, we hope, of the pandemic. Don, education brought you and I together. I was just a wayward lad back in 1982 when you found me and lifted me up and told me I was going to be the next Chris Thomas. So as much as we do these educational pieces and talk about things, I know your granddaughter's coming back from Roanoke. We have all these things going on for Thanksgiving. You're trying to stay away from your family. So as the former county executive, I also know you have some messaging out there for the youth as well.
Well, I tell you what, Nestor, we have messaging for the youth. We're going to look at serious topics today, and we are so, so pleased to have as our guest professor from the Maryland Institute, Dr. Furman D. Brabander, not the Oriole pitcher of the past, Brabander, but Dr. Furman D. Brabander. And Nestor, we're going to...
He's laughing because he gets that. You get that in Baltimore,
no,
right?
I understand. From
old-timers?
No, I'm laughing. I'm laughing because I'm trying to think of the new Baltimore Positive and the topics that we tackle. And today, we are going to tackle with one of the true national experts on these issues, the issue of privacy in a digital age, and the whole issue of whether or not gun safety and guns actually make us safer or less safe. You talk about topics that could take hours, and we're going to try to do it in about a half an hour. But Dr. Brabander, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
We're just delighted to have you. Yet, you know, before we even get into the book, and full disclosure, Furman's wife and I have known each other for a long time. She is one of the truly outstanding education advocates in Baltimore County. She's one of the people in our communities that make the whole system work. And because of that, I know you have a number of children. I know you've tried not only to survive being a college professor in the age of COVID, and Nestor and I have talked to a lot of educators since this began, but you've also been like all the rest of us and all my kids, thrust right into the middle of now trying to teach your kids at home. Give us some insights, both of those things, being a college professor during COVID and then being a parent trying to make virtual education work.
Well, I just wrote about this the other day, how like my world has been turned upside down. Forever when I was in the classroom, I would tell my students, get off your computer, get off your cell phones, close your laptops. I want to talk
right
to you.
Now so much for that.
Now I have to tell them, open your laptops and look at me. And I don't know what else you're doing on there. And with my kids, I'd always say, get rid of the cell phone. And now they have to have their cell phone next to them to communicate with their classmates. And they have to be staring at their computers all day. It's really... I'm not a fan of it, but this is the world, you know, under COVID. This is how they have to do it. So it is what it is. But, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll be out of this soon, you know. Listen, my kids are teenagers, so I feel lucky. I think I have an easier time. If my kids were younger, like in elementary school, it would be a lot more difficult, I think.
No, it's a challenge. Go ahead, Nestor.
No, every day we talk to parents about this. And I think for me, my experience with what you do for a living is when my my then 15, 16-year-old, the stepsister of my wife. So sort of a different generation. This happened 15 years ago, was deciding on where to go and leaving home and going to school and coming to Baltimore and being, you know, on some sort of an artistic track and communicating with the world. It really is amazing how much this has all changed just very, very quickly, that if you're a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid right now trying to navigate this world with your parents and figuring, where am I going to be in a year or two or three?
And I have a son who's going to go to college next year, so I'm hopeful this will be over. You know, I don't know what that would be like if he, God forbid, he has to stay in my basement for one more year. I mean, I'd love it personally, but I think he needs the college experience. Well, on that note, Nestor, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about and writing about is, how is academia going to change after this? You know, I can't speak to like high schools, but I'm thinking at the college level, you know, people are thinking there might be some big changes that have come out of this because, you know, tuitions have been skyrocketing for years and the business plan of higher education has been in need of reform. But I don't know that having all my students online is the reform we need, you know. But some things for sure are going to change. I think, you know, I was really not very familiar with all these technology like Zoom, which we're using now. I had no clue about this 6 months ago. Now suddenly I'm up to speed. You know, I could see myself using some of these in the future, but by no means do I want this to replace the good old fashioned classroom setting. You know, I think we have to have a reckoning and admit it's not the same.
Yeah. Boy, that's the way. They're the golden words, right? It's not the same. Well, no. Let's jump into your latest book, which, boy, did it resonate. And again, for folks out there, available wherever you get your books, obviously at the major national institutions that we all know, but Life After Privacy, Reclaiming Democracy in a Surveillance Society. I think people hear that title and they go, boy, they've got a million thoughts right away. I'm going to start with, I looked at a number of interviews, and it seems like in every interview that you do, or when you're talking about the book, or when people are writing about the book, they start with the basic question, what is privacy? So Nestor and I are going to say to you, educate our listeners, educate us. How do you define privacy?
Oh, well, that was actually the first job I thought I had to do in this book, because one thing I noticed is that people presume they know what privacy is, but the more I push them on the topic, they don't have a clue. And, you know, we have a lot of civil libertarians in this country, you know, the ACLU and Edward Snowden, well, he's not in this country anymore, but Daniel Ellsberg, you know, there's a lot of people who are very intent on saving our privacy. I don't think the general American public is along for the ride. I don't think most people really care much about their privacy for a variety of reasons. We're not allowed to, we're not able to. But at the end of the day, one of the things I discovered, you know, in writing this book was that I don't think privacy has a very easy definition at all. I think privacy at the end is hopelessly, ill-formed, and maybe it can't even be formed as a notion. The great Supreme Court Justice of the United States, Louis Brandeis, he defined it back at the end of the 1800s as the right to be left alone. Well, I mean, okay, that sounds easy enough, but you know, when you really think about it, who makes sure that you're left alone, right? Isn't it up to you? Like, so I give the example of like, you know, I don't like to be pressured by the eyes of other people. Okay, but then so, you know, maybe I'll find a quiet space and close the door. But, you know, I might still carry that judgment with me, right? So, you know, like the boundaries are hopelessly blurred. You know, so the question I would ask is, if I was asked this, like, am I ever really private? Do I ever really have a private space where I'm free of judgment? You know, I can be my own worst critic, for example.
Well, Furman, one of the things that you said there, and I've read you in other articles alluding to this, and I need you to expand upon it because it caught me by surprise, and that is the premise that you have that Americans don't really care about their privacy.
Yeah.
I think folks would be – that's counterintuitive to me.
Yeah, it was counterintuitive to me as well. I'll tell you, I got into this study because I started writing this book. It came out in 2013 is when the idea started, after Edward Snowden uncovered what was going on in the NSA. And I stormed into class with my students. I said, isn't this terrible? Isn't this awful? What he's done, what he's uncovered, what your government is doing. And I just couldn't get the students on board. They just didn't. They didn't seem to feel the same appreciation. They certainly couldn't defend privacy. Their position was, well, you know, this is the cost of living in our digital society, and I have nothing to hide. I've heard that over and over again. Why should I worry? I have nothing to hide. So, you know,
we all have something to hide, by the way. We all have something to hide. We do.
That was my position. Maybe they're not old enough yet.
Well, I would say that I'm 52, and I've been a public figure for like three decades. So I've lived a different kind of life, where very early on I figured out that, like, I don't have the same rights as other people. That literally, I was told by every lawyer when I was being harassed, threatened. You know, I've got stacks of hate mail, 20 years old. So I felt like I gave it up. And I sort of feel like in this Facebook world, like from 2008, 9, and 10, where I got in and I saw other people insult other people. Yeah. You know, online, you know, the nastiness of it. And I thought, well, now it's caught up to me because everyone's just out there. And if you're going to be out there with whatever your personal situation is, your pictures, what you're doing on a Friday night, and I'm from Dundalk. So, you know, I saw a wide variety of different things people were willing to share about their lives and things that I thought, like, you know, being a public figure, I wouldn't share that about, whatever it would be. I just think in the last decade, it's gone, you know, and I don't know what age it started, whether it would be X or G or generation X or Z or where it would be that those people are born. When the mother and father puts the baby on Instagram, literally day one, and that picture is up, I do wonder how much this has changed from, let's say, where our founders wanted us to be or expected us to be, right?
Well, how about the Brelfie, Nestor? You know about the Brelfie? These are selfies of women breastfeeding, you know, and they're very close up and intimate, you know. So, I mean, the whole notion of, I've argued that the whole notion of shame is completely gone in the Facebook age, you know. But I see this especially in younger generation, like my college students. Their notion of privacy is completely different from mine. They don't care about sharing anything, right? They're happy to share any and everything. And I've had to, you know, unfriend a couple of my former students because I, God forbid, my kids peer over my shoulder and see what's going on Facebook. You know, I got to be careful. But
wow.
My general point is, you know, I just don't, you know, so the younger generation, I don't think they have any notion of privacy at all anymore. It's completely acculturated out of them. But I've argued that even like the older generation, you know, privacy is endangered because, listen, you know, we're happy. So, you know, researchers have done all these studies where they have noted that people will say on one hand that they care about privacy, but when the rubber hits the road and they're given what are called trade-offs, which means like they're given like promotions by marketers in exchange for giving personal information, people happily do this over and over and over again. And I mean, it's just the fact of the matter.
Even to the Russians.
Okay.
Cambridge Analytica. I mean, this is how minds are altered. This is how Facebook operates to keep us on that thing all day, right?
Like, oh, absolutely.
It's designed for this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking about just regular marketers as well, like the Amazons of the world. They know that we are happy to get their incentives and their what we call personalized marketing. You know, we're happy to receive all this. So people will tend to be forthcoming. But at the end of the day, Nestor, we don't have to be. So what I've written is that our spies don't have to work very hard, okay? On one hand, we are happy to give up all this information. But I have bad news for you. Even if you were to try and be more careful, they will find that information anyway. Because it turns out that our spies, and by the way, our spies, the bulk, you know, the most interesting and aggressive spies, and the greatest number of them, they're in the private sector. They're not in the public sector. So,
Furman, I want to jump. I'm so
define
glad
that spy. Was actually, by the way, I want to hear what spy is.
Well, and what Furman just said was, I had a little note written in my margin. That's another thing that jumped out of your book to me which I think, folks, I thought at first, well, maybe they'll be surprised by that. And then I thought, nah, no, they won't. And here's why. And that's this issue where you talk about, is the biggest concern private, and we'll get to Nestor's question, private spying, private surveillance, or government spying and government surveillance? And I thought, geez, I think more people would be worried about government. And then I thought, I bet I've had 10 people, without exaggeration, Furman, in the past month say to me, it's the strangest thing. I went on to look at a pair of sunglasses online. You know, I wanted to see what's on. And all of a sudden, in every single feed that I have, I'm getting ad after ad.
No, I'll tell you what. I threw out 20 random texts out of my text on Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, I woke up and all those people were in the front of my Facebook feed. And it had nothing to do with Facebook. So, I know it's all integrated. That's why I've given up, Doc. You know what I mean? Like, that's why I'm not fighting it.
So tell Nestor why he shouldn't give up, why he should continue to fight it, and how you define spying. How can you do that in less than an hour and a half?
I use the word spy because it's easy, you know, but you're right. Like, they don't have to spy. Once upon a time, they had to snoop around, but digital technology has made it so that they don't have to do hardly anything at all.
It's impossible, right? If you pay a bill, if you have a phone, if you use a credit card, if you have a bank, right? If you have a social security number, right? Like, the worry is always the government taking information from you, but we're happily giving it away, right?
The point I was also building up to is they don't even need your data. They want your metadata. And the metadata is the data of your data. They don't care to read your emails. They don't need to read your emails. They don't need to see what you're buying. They just need to see where you go. They can see when you email. They can see the length of the emails. And that stuff is easily accessible. Right. So you don't have to give much for them to find a lot about you. That's the unfortunate news.
Well, thinking again about your book, is your book hopeful or pessimistic?
Oh, I'm optimistic by nature. No, I'm not going to be. I mean, I have bad news if you care about privacy, but I don't, you know, at the end of the day, like I'm a very optimistic person. And I've argued that, so the real question I got into with this book is, my specialty is really political philosophy and political theory. And I really wanted to know, you know, what does this mean for democracy? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who think we need privacy in order to have a democracy. And I concluded otherwise. I concluded, no, we don't need, we don't need privacy in order to keep this democracy. We don't need privacy in order to maintain our freedom. So that's the line that I take.
So, go ahead, Nestor.
Yeah, I want to bring this thing full circle because we are in the middle of this plague in the Far East. Everyone checked in. Yeah. I spent time last year in Korea, spent time in Japan last year. Different culture, different way they think about the culture, the way they think about other citizens, the care that they have, the spatial issues that they live with as well, that we don't have in Iowa, let's say. Mm-hmm. But in this country, the notion that I'm going to give the man where I've been and who I've been 6 feet away from. Yeah. I've watched the NFL do this. We had Dick Cass on a couple months ago where they have 6-foot wristbands in their building so that they can detect someone so Lamar doesn't get it. Yeah. If we were doing this the right way and we really cared about each other, we would all have a locator and be. And we have seen there, as Charlie Ekman would say in Baltimore, there ain't no way that's ever going to happen in America where everyone's going to do this, not even with a plague that's now cost us 250,000 lives.
I know. I mean, the way they were able to tackle this pandemic in China was through extreme surveillance. In some cases, I read they were focusing CCTV cameras right on people's front doors to make sure they did not leave, you know. So very intense surveillance that we would never put up with in this country. But, you know, Americans are funny. On the one hand, we say, you know, we care deeply about our privacy and we care deeply, you know, we don't want people to know. We don't want to share that information with the man. But at the same token, we're doing this all the time when we use Yelp, when we use our GPS. You know, that information is out there. We just don't I don't know. What? Do we know it? Do we process it? That's the interesting philosophical question. Like, people should, they should know this. They should recognize they're giving away this data already.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're driving around in your car, you're watching us on the computer, we are with Maryland Institute professor, Dr. Furman D. Brabander. Two books that should absolutely be on every bookshelf. Get on and buy them today. One is Life After Privacy, Reclaiming Democracy in a Surveillance Society. His other book that generated a lot of buzz just a few years ago, Do Guns Make Us Free? We'll talk about that momentarily. But before we dive into the gun issue, Furman, you also talked about your concern about freedom in the public square.
Yeah.
And you actually took some encouragement from what you saw evolve out of the Black Lives Matter movement this past summer. And I wonder if you can connect that to privacy and your concern for the public square.
Absolutely. Well, what I end up arguing is that democracy doesn't rely so much on the private sphere. It relies on the public sphere. And the public sphere is also, you know, pretty endangered in the digital era. You know, we have all these genuinely public spaces. Like I live in Towson, so I'm thinking of the Courthouse Square in Towson. You know, that is a genuinely public space. What I mean by genuinely public space is there's no shopping, no selling. It's just there to be public. Most Americans, they tend to treat the shopping mall as the public space where they would go to convene, but they don't realize that that is a private place, right? It's privately owned, so you can't really walk in there and demonstrate and whatnot. But public association and public convening, this is really the basis of political power. It is not having your own private realm, right? Especially in this day when privacy is so endangered, right? It's really about political power starts with public organizing, right? And so I actually thought hard, I thought the Black Lives Matter was an impressive movement, but I thought back to like the civil rights movement of the 60s, and I thought back to the labor movement, and I thought, you know what? They never had any privacy, and they were able to overcome that. And through intensive organization, they were able to, you know, start these movements that brought real political change.
Well, in the case for here and in Baltimore and what we've experienced here and seeing new mayor, new thoughts, where are you for the future of our city on the other side of this, clearly in the educational space? There's a lot of things here for youth. I mean, I had Tori Smith on, who's made a great investment over in West Baltimore. There are lots of people trying to lift boats here. From an organizational perspective and a civic perspective for you, we're all trying to find the Baltimore positive part of this as we get up on our Thanksgiving meal next week.
Well, I mean, I like I said, I'm optimistic by nature, and I'm a big fan of Baltimore, and Baltimore has amazing spaces and has amazing architecture. I don't, you know, for living, it's a wonderful city that I think, you know, for people to live in, and, you know, it's one of the things that really fascinates me to think about what is going to happen after COVID. You know, what is going to bring people back into the cities? What is going to, because work is different, right? People don't need to work anymore in the city. People don't need to study in the city. You know, well, I mean, schools can be done digitally. You certainly don't need to shop in the city, right? You don't need to go to the mall anymore. But even though all those changes have happened, we also see that people tend to want to be together, right? People tend to want to be, this is one of the great things that people are missing under COVID. I see this in my own students, right? Functionally, they're okay. But emotionally, they're missing each other deeply, right? So what does the city give us? The city gives us this social life, you know, just for being together that I think will endure, you know? And so I'm optimistic that Baltimore will bounce back, but I don't know what it's going to look like, right? The downtown, that might look radically different, for example. That might turn into a residential area because you certainly...
Well, I hope so, because I live down here. I'd like to sell my right. condo at some point, which is how this whole thing began, you know?
Right. But, you know, you don't need to work down there necessarily. You don't need to shop down there. So what's going to draw people? I think living arrangements, making our neighborhoods livable and attractive and friendly and community oriented. This is the future, and this is the way to save Baltimore. And I've always been encouraged by the kind of people that move and live in the city, move to the city and live there. They look for those things.
Well, I think of it as an incredible opportunity, right? Especially, like, I'm all in on Baltimore Positive. I've moved a 30-year sports radio brand into this space because I feel like I'm 52, and when I'm 72, there better have been better things going on here. And you know, listen, I've traveled all over the world, and I've seen places up and down, and my people are from Venezuela. I mean, I can't even go back to Venezuela. I saw Caracas had the worst cost of living in the world, right? The opposite of the best, the least expensive place in the world, which is also the most dangerous place in the world. Yeah. But then next door, Colombia, and places like Cartagena, Medellin, which were thought to be the rat traps of the world 40 years ago, have picked themselves up. I had a friend in Medellin last week. There's opportunity here above and beyond the Detroits and the Cleveland and these malign places that over the next 25 years, it's going to be so local though, right? It's because it's not going to come from Washington. Maybe theoretically it is wherever you are. And even though it's 38 miles away, every one of these communities that's going to suffer through this part of change in our country, it's going to be built up from here to the end of the street. It's going to have to be local.
Yeah, I think so. And it's going to be different types of attraction too, right? They're not going to be able to sell these areas and neighborhoods on this is close to work or this is close to shopping. They're going to have to reimagine, you know, what is it that you're going to sell this neighborhood on? And I think it's going to be like community life and living close to your neighbors, you know, and I think there is deep attraction for that. You know, what one of the things that I'm sad about, and I mentioned in my book, is that, like, one of the things that suburbia has done in America, and by the way, suburbia is designed for privacy, right? You have your yard, you got your backyard, you got your fence, you got your basement, you don't have to see a person, you know? But what is missing in the older forms of neighborhood, like, I think of, like, so I teach in Bolton Hill, you know, you used to have corner bars on every block or a pharmacy, and these little pocket parks. Bolton Hill was designed for easy association, where you would see your neighbors and even strangers on a daily basis. And I think that's very important. That's not what we see in digital media, right? Digital media is highly curated. I only have to see the people I want to see. I don't have to hear voices I don't want to hear, right? But our lived environment once upon a time, you know, was where you would easily associate with people from all different walks of life.
Don, we've lost your audio on your end there. I think you've muted yourself at your source there. Don Mohler's here, former Baltimore County Executive. We're doing Baltimore Positive. And Dr. Furman D. Brabander joining us here from Micah and up the street. Neighbors here for us. You know, I want to go back to gun safety and turning the community around, because we talk about the safety and we talk about where Baltimore is. Look, I've worn an Oriole hat and I've worn a Ravens hat and I've got the proud to be Baltimore everywhere I've ever gone, and I've seen this conversation change from when I was a younger man in the 90s. I would, you know, say to someone, I'm from Baltimore, they'd like be like, Cal Ripken, crab cakes, Fort McHenry, went there, went to the aquarium, spent a weekend there, daughter had a convention there, son went there for work, Johns Hopkins, all of that. You know, Simon makes the wire.
Yeah,
I like Simon. It's all good, you know, and then the cop show comes and Homicide and Life on the Street and Belzer's in town and Ice-T. And the next thing you know, we take on this narrative and the Freddie Gray tragedy. We have all of this happen. And now all of a sudden when I, you know, it's we're like an inside joke somewhere, like the way maybe we used to make fun of other places, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in sports radio or, you know, fun morning radio. But for my purposes, Baltimore being sort of the brunt of the joke, that's why we started Baltimore Positive. And I know we all recruit to this and we've all experienced this outside of Baltimore, but I think lifting us up with the gun thing, which brings us back to your other essay, we got to solve this problem.
Absolutely. No, I mean, this was a longstanding issue that I grew up thinking about. You know, I grew up here. I'm from Towson originally. So I've always been wondering about the guns in America. And my dad's an immigrant and from Belgium. And he would always say things to me like, he loves America, but he'd say, I just don't get the guns. You know, I don't get the guns. I said, well, I'll do you a favor. I'm going to really try and understand it. So I did a deep dive. And, you know, I learned a couple things, Nestor, is that our gun culture has changed over the years, you know. So right now, I've described it, we're at a pinnacle of the gun rights movement. 20 years ago, we were not, okay? 20 years ago, Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, he was in favor of universal background checks. 20 years is not a long time. Something has changed in the last two decades that really amped this up.
Probably the Russian money, but other than that, probably.
Well, I think it's a cultural thing, right? There's more and more Americans that are on board with this radical gun rights movement, this total expansive movement towards guns rights, right? Where there's no holds barred. You can't have universal background checks. You know, you have guns on college campuses. You have stand your ground. The list goes on. People are all in okay with these things. Of course, the constant through it all is that Baltimore City has suffered from extreme gun violence throughout it, right? That has not quite wavered. I mean, during the O'Malley years, it went down a little bit, but it's been back up. But Baltimore has always suffered through this, unfortunately.
Don, you are still muted. Don's having a little audio technical difficulties here, the technical difficulties blues. For this and for solving this, when clearly the lobby is so pushed the other side. And Doc, I'll be honest with you, and I don't know that I've admitted this, but Baltimore Positive really came about and was birthed the morning after the Lock Raven gun lockdown. You're a Towson guy, so you can have appreciation for this. Yeah. In the middle of that, I kind of lost my mind because my facility where I broadcast from, Don's back in. Hey, Don, how are you?
Hey, I don't know what happened there.
Well, your mic is – you still have your bad mic connected, so unconnect that. You're working off your studio mic. So mute down for me if you can, Don. So at Lock Raven High School – that day there was a lockdown, and I'm watching it on TV. I'm watching Choppers. Literally, Lock Raven High School sits next to the facility that I broadcast from, the land I own, the tower I broadcast from, so much so that for 15 years of broadcasting there, I could open the window in my studio and hear the whistles and the pom-poms and the sound of football helmets and the sound of field hockey and, you know, all of the sounds of sports live on the field. And the school's under lockdown, and I had a sponsor who the next day has never paid a $12,500 bill, a Towson-based company that was so offended that I wanted the guns away that they dropped the sponsorship, didn't pay the bill, never answered the phone again. And when I went to their page, they're now on Parler and they're MAGA and they're, and this is what, 2.5 years, how long ago it's been? This was a month after Parkland. You know what I mean? Like the sensitivity to it. And when I had the conversation, the thing that blew my mind, because I had never spoken to anyone like this in my life, their argument was every teacher should have a firearm, that's the way to make us safe. And I'm thinking to myself, I've never thought this in my life. And the next day there was actually a Twitter lobby for this, that they want my librarian, they want Don Moeller, who was my high school guidance counselor, to be armed in classrooms. And I thought, my God, that anyone could make this argument is insane to me. But the fact that I'm in the other end of an argument with someone I've known for 15 years, and this was now their position, that every teacher in America have a firearm, I thought, how fringe are you? And then I realized 70 million people voted that way 2 weeks ago. And I'm wondering, maybe I'm the fringe. I mean, am I losing my mind? I'm your father in Belgium. I'm my friends in Australia who cannot wrap their arms around this, and I can't relent because arming teachers is a bad idea.
I don't know why people think this is okay. That's what I don't understand. I don't know why people think this is acceptable. I always say, we do not have to live like this. You know, we don't have to live like this, right? We do not have to live like this. You know, we are unnecessarily making our city, you know, and our country into a war zone. Right? You know, where teachers are armed and there's, you know, bulletproof armor in the classroom. There's a manufacturer on the Eastern Shore in about 2010, they transitioned from making armor-plated tanks to making armor-plated wall coverings that they could sell in U.S. high schools. You know, this is insane. we don't have to live like this, you know? But what you're talking about, Nestor, is that, and this is where it really gets interesting for me as a philosopher, is, you know, this got all wrapped up into notions of, you know, of what it means to be free. You know, people take this so seriously. My, you know, that was a very controversial book I wrote about guns. I got into a lot of trouble with a lot of people about that book. You know, I was surprised.
Good trouble, I hope, as was once spoken about.
I like to think it was good trouble, but you are right. It is an issue that, for whatever reason, really sets off alarm bells, and people get really sensitive about. They get really, like, angry about it.
I couldn't believe that in order to keep a sponsorship that I had with a client that they wanted me to go on the air and pitch that theory. And I'm thinking to myself, why, you know, there comes a point where we all have to push back at some point and say, is this nuts? My pushback has literally been Baltimore Positive. We appreciate you coming on. Dr. Furman, DeBrabander here from MICA, writing books about gun safety, gun control, and privacy. These incredible conversations. Don, do we have you mic'd up where we need to have you?
Can you hear
yes,
me now?
Yes, you're beautiful. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, before we let Dr. DeBrabander go, because I love the way you connected, and I remember the controversy, Furman, around the book and articles, subsequent articles that you wrote, but you connected. I thought the beauty of what you did was the connection of it to political philosophers, and particularly, not only did you talk about John Locke, but your connection to Machiavelli and his concept of illusion of freedom, because I thought that speaks to so much, I think, of what Nestor is saying, what you're learning. Talk about that illusion of freedom and guns and connected to Machiavelli, because I thought, you know, you don't have to be a political philosopher to understand what Furman's talking about there.
Well, I mean, the title kind of sums it up. Do guns make us free? The answer is no. But the funny thing is, so what the NRA has really thrived on in the gun rights movement is they have very successfully linked up the idea of guns with freedom. And what I was arguing in the book is, you know, listen, I love the public health experts. We have the Bloomberg School in Baltimore, and they put forth very, I think, convincing data about the problem with all these guns and, you know, the kind of casualties we have to live with. But at the end of the day, the scientific and the public health arguments and even the legal arguments about gun control are not as potent as the NRA arguments about freedom. So I was saying, you know, we got to hit that argument straight on, you know. The gun control side, the liberals, whatever, the Democrats, you have to speak to people's deep emotions here and say, listen, you know, you're not freer for having all these guns. Your freedom is compromised. You are less free. And this idea hit me the day after Sandy Hook. This book was born, my gun book was born the day after Sandy Hook, when I was taking my kid to, we were talking about his 12th birthday party. He was going to take some friends to a movie theater. And he says to me in the car, listening to Sandy Hook, you know, he says, I don't think I want to go to the movie theater with my friends. And I thought, well, God, you know, this is not making us free. We have to live a cowering life as a result of all these stupid guns all over the place. So, you know, I think, you know, the public health arguments are correct, but we need to transcend that. And we need to talk in terms of just straight up liberty and freedom. You know, we're less free to speak out. We're less free to assemble. We're less free to do whatever we want as a result of all these guns out there. And, you know, the tie-in with Machiavelli is that Machiavelli is always talking about, you know, the illusion of freedom versus real freedom. And guns give the illusion of freedom, but they don't deliver real freedom, okay? They deliver quite the opposite.
Now, you know, you mentioned whether or not your child wants to go to the theater, wants to go in a public place. Nestor's heard me tell this story before, and it's why we have to continue to have these discussions. And I think you make it clear in your book, you're not necessarily opposed to gun ownership with safety regulation. And I think that's one of the things.
I don't know what percentage of America would say no one should have a gun. Right. I mean, that's single digits.
Right, and that's where the Democrats have not done a great job on communicating that. And
especially in hunting week, because everybody's out hunting this week, right? So I have no issue with that.
I've shared before, very similar to your story, Furman, is that right after Parkland, my daughter sat my granddaughter down, who I guess was a junior in high school at that time, at breakfast. And it's a heartbreaking story. And she said, "Hon, I need you to listen to me today when you go to Catonsville High School." mm-hmm. that I want you to pay close attention should you ever have an active shooter. Here's what I need you to do. Yeah. And my granddaughter began to cry.
Yeah.
And it goes to your point about we're not freer, we're not it's safer, terrible. We're not more. And she said, Mom, I don't like to talk about this. And my daughter said, Ellie, I know you don't like to talk about this, honey, but we have to talk about this. And again, great books by Dr. Furman Debray-Bander, Life After Privacy, Reclaiming Democracy in a Surveillance Society. His other book, Do Guns Make Us Free? They need to be on your bookshelves. One quick thing before you get away, because it made me laugh, and I think of Nestor, who's also an author. You said, one of the folks that interviewed you said, you know, your books, what I like about them is they're fairly short. They're quick reads. They're not really long books. And they said, why is that? And you said, I don't like long books.
I'm impatient by nature.
Tell us what that's all about.
I'm impatient by nature, but I also am a favor of being succinct. My favorite writing is concise. You know, so if you can't say it in 200 words, you know, I think there is an issue. I'm sorry. write another book at that point, you know.
My favorite comment. Well, this has been a great conversation. I hope you'll become a regular. And Nestor, take us out of here.
Doc, great visiting with you. Thanks for coming on. Great topics. And a couple we don't tackle enough here, but we will be tackling a little more. We're going to be talking with Gianna Taboni from Vice Networks, who is an alum here about the Boogaloo Boys and about right wings and guns. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing that a little later on in the week at Baltimore Positive as well. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, you can find all of our work now in one place. We're Baltimore Positive. You can subscribe on Stitcher or Apple or iTunes, any of those places, just to the pods. You can find our whole colorful world now at BaltimorePositive.com. Ness at BaltimorePositive.com finds me. Sports, music, arts, and a lot of politics all in one place now. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.